Join me, Dr. Kathy Weston, for my podcast series, Get a Grip, brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. In each podcast, I help unpick some of the trickier questions relating to how we raise children today. How do we talk to children about mental health? How can we make sure our children engage safely with the digital world? Whose responsibility is the mental health education of our children, teachers or parents? These podcasts get me talking and you thinking. I've reached out to today's thought leaders and main researchers in this area and asked them their views on the areas where we need to get a grip. Peter Worley is a visiting research associate at King's College London. He's a multi-award winning author for Bloomsbury Education and author and editor of the Philosophy Foundation series of books. He's CEO of the Philosophy Foundation that trains philosophy graduates, classroom teachers, and has been doing philosophy with children in schools every week since 2002. Peter developed the method of philosophical inquiry that is at the heart of the Philosophy Foundation's work as captured in his first book, The If Machine, Philosophical Inquiry in the Classroom. The If Odyssey and The Philosophy Shop were both shortlisted for Educational Book of the Year in 2013, with The Philosophy Shop winning this. In 2014, his fifth book, Once Upon an If, The Story Thinking Handbook, was shortlisted for the Educational Resources Award, as was his latest book, 40 Lessons to Get Children Thinking. He's also given two TEDx talks about philosophy in schools, How to Be a Rebel, and Plato, Not Play-Doh. Welcome, Peter. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks, Kathy.
Now, I have to say it's a little bit daunting speaking to a philosopher on this podcast, because normally I know a little bit about what I'm asking podcast guests about, but I'm really, you know, a bit of a novice when it comes to philosophy. So I'm hoping that you can enlighten us as to the great benefits of philosophy for children and give us ideas, both as parents and educators, how we can, you know, develop children's thinking at home and at school.
I'd be happy to. Yeah, I mean, I think philosophy is one of those daunting words. People find it a little bit intimidating. And the nice thing about working with children is that they don't have any of those preconceptions and prejudices about it. So, you know, even when they can't say the word properly, they can still do philosophy by just thinking about stuff in the right kind of way. So that's quite nice. But let me give you a short definition. A very nice short definition that I've heard many times is that it's thinking about thinking, which gives us a nice starting place. But then, of course, psychology is also thinking about thinking. So I have my own short definition of what philosophy is, and it's this. It's everything within reason. Everything within reason. So the idea is that we can really, when we're doing philosophy, we think about almost anything at all, but we put it under some sort of critical examination, which is where the reason comes from.
And this is really where I think parents can totally appreciate the value of that. And children are almost natural philosophers, certainly when they're very young, the way they ask very interesting questions. But I think the bit that we all may struggle with, and I actually have that lovely book that you wrote for educators, 40 Lessons to Get Children Thinking. At the introduction of that, it says philosophy done well should be a rigorous, structured, sequential conversation with others or oneself that is both collaborative and oppositional, that attempts to explore, explain, and justify the structure and content of our thoughts in response to perceived problems and puzzles about reality, knowledge, value, and meaning. And that is very, very clear. But I think it is the methodology that parents would probably struggle with. And I think it would be amazing if you could help us find a sort of a framework for, or even model how we might have a particular philosophical conversation with our children.
So I've been thinking about this for many, many years. And, you know, started doing this in sort of 2002, I think. So I've been thinking about how I can boil down the basic method to a simple structure and a simple format. And the way I think of it now is that it all starts with the conditions of dialectic. And that might sound a little bit daunting. So dialectic is just I'm using it in the way the ancient Greeks used it. It just means question and answer investigation, right? Where two people usually, but it could be with oneself, discuss together and go deeper with questions and answers, to follow a line of inquiry and to investigate and systematically and thoughtfully. So that's kind of what we're doing. And the conditions of dialectic are very simple. All you need to be able to do is to think and to speak and to listen. So when I go into a classroom and I say to the children, what we're going to do is philosophy, the first thing I do is I draw a triangle on the board and put a question mark in the middle. And at the top corner, I write think. The bottom left corner, I write speak. And at the bottom right corner, it has listen. And I say to them, that's all I'm going to ask you to do is think, speak, and listen, usually in answer to a question, hence the question mark in the middle. So I call this the dialectical triangle. To the children, I call it the philosophy triangle. And if you're using it in non-philosophy context, you could just call it the talk triangle. And that's all you really need to do is give them an opportunity to think, speak, and listen. Not necessarily in that order. It doesn't really matter what order they start in. So if I ask you a question, like, you know, let's go back to the famous Heraclitean question, can you step in the same river twice? All I'm going to ask you to do is to think about that and say something. So what's the first thing, Kathy, that comes into your head when I say, can you step into the same river twice?
Uh-oh. Let me have a little think. Can you step into the same river twice?
And don't think. Don't think, Kathy. That's the point. This whole thing starts with not thinking. What's the first thing that just springs into your head? Is it a yes? Is it a no?
It's a no. I'm not quite sure why it's a no, but it's a no.
Okay. So then that's the interesting thing, is that when doing philosophy in this way, you're drawing out the intuitions first. You're not thinking. The first rule of philosophy's club is don't think, surprisingly. Just let the first thoughts come into your head almost intuitively. And just let them just appear. So if your first answer was no, then what I might do is say to you, can you say why it's no?
Yeah, that's really helpful. So you sort of surface their first thoughts and responses. And then the next part of it, the methodology, is really just asking questions that allow them to think about why they've actually thought that particular thought.
That's right. So when you said no, can you say anything at all about why you said no?
I think for some reason I had an image in my mind of somebody wading through the river, and once you've done it, if that makes sense.
Right. Once you've done it, you've done it. So can you step into the same river twice? If once you've done it, you've done it.
So it's really about, yeah. So already I'm kind of, I mean, this is a new way of thinking for me.
Yeah. So when you said already I'm kind of, what were you about to say?
I think already I'm enjoying the process that I thought might be quite knotty and difficult, but actually it's quite fun, and actually it opens up your mind to completely different questions and ways of thinking.
So the next thing to do would be, if you've said no and you've just given your reason, imagine a 6-year-old child just said exactly what you just said. And by the way, you know, they could. I mean, very often children do say things that are very similar to what we say as adults. So what I would then do is go to another child in the group and ask them the same question. And I'd see what I might do to try and build the dialectic, the discussion, is I might see if there's anybody who thinks yes. Seeing as you said no, let's go and see if there's someone in the room who thinks yes, you can step in the same river twice. And then ask them why they think that. And the moment you start listening to what the other one is saying, you start going, oh, actually, I hadn't thought of that. That's a good point.
So it also requires listening and sharing perspectives. What are the things I wanted to ask you about? Are you referring there to what you have previously described as the 4 R's of philosophy? Children are responding to something, right, to a problem. They're saying that's not fair, for example, which children have a strong sense of justice, so they're responding to something. And then you're inviting them to reflect. That's the second R word. And then that reasoning.
That's right.
And then the reevaluation is sort of the consensus building at the end of the conversation.
That's right, yeah. Well, not so much consensus building, because, of course, they may not reach a consensus. That's the lovely thing about philosophy. But yes, that's right. So the first point is the 4 R's are responsive, reflective, reasoned, and reevaluative. And they nicely capture the method of philosophy and what we do. So when you put a question like, can you step into the same river twice, to the children, the first thing you do is just say, respond. Don't think, just respond. Just let the first thing that comes into your head come out. Of course, if I'm working with nursery, I don't have to tell them that. It'll come out anyway, right? They'll just go yes or no or whatever it is that comes into their head. So that's the idea. Just let, it's a very responsive thing. And if you ask, but the key here is asking the right kind of question to allow that to happen.
That's right. So can you give us, say, your top five questions that are really, really fun for parents to practice this technique?
Right. Well, what I'd rather do is tell you the type of question I use, and then you can do as many as you like.
Okay.
So the type of question I use is what I've called a grammatically closed question, but conceptually open. So when we do philosophy, we very often think we need to ask open questions. But if I ask questions to you like, or to children like, what is art? They struggle with that. It's way too open. Only the articulate and those with cultural capital can really engage in questions like that. And the ones that are used to discussing over the dinner table and the ones that have been to art galleries. Those ones can engage in a question like, what is art, much more easily. Whereas very young children or children who are less used to those contexts would find it very difficult. So, but if I draw a smiley face, hold it up and say to you, is this art? Everyone can join in. And you'll have a hard time not having everyone join in. If I just hold up a smiley face and say, is this art? You'll hear a class go, yes, no, all at the same time. And that's what we start with. We start with those beginnings. And it comes from the type of question that we ask. Grammatically closed, which means that it elicits a yes or no response. Like, can you step in the same river twice? Is this art? But it has to be a question which is conceptually open. So when you say, can you step in the same river twice? It's conceptually open because, well, what do we mean by same? What do we mean by river? What do we mean by stepping in? And those relationships between those different aspects of the question are contestable. The children will have lots of different things to say about them. So that's the key thing, is to ask a grammatically closed question that elicits a yes, no, short phrase answer, but which is conceptually open and has aspects of it which are contestable and interesting. In other words, there's an open question lying behind it. So when I ask, is this art? The open question is, well, what is art? But the is this art allows us to intuitively approach it without having to necessarily have our fully articulated responses before we answer.
And that kind of visual cue of the sort of smiley face that you're giving children allows them to quite rapidly reach that intuitive response that sort of initiates the conversation.
That's exactly right. So we use a lot of those kinds of stimuli. So for instance, if I'm doing the, can you step in the same river twice? What I'll often do is do a version of that with a ship. And I'll do a model of a ship on the floor with pencils. And then I'll tell a story about how the ship sails around and one bit gets broken and take one of the pencils off and replace it with another. Keep doing that until all the pencils have been replaced. And once they can see that all the pencils have been replaced, I simply say, so is this the same ship? And the nice thing about that is the question I'm really asking is a ship that's had its parts replaced gradually over time the same ship? That's the question I'm really asking. But that's quite a long question to ask and a bit abstract. So what I've done is I've taken half the question away from the actual question formulation and simply put it into a context, a visual context. So when I ask the question, is it the same ship? That aspect of it is implied in the context. And the children will say all sorts of things because they've just seen the ship replaced gradually over time. So that's another trick, is using visual devices and clues to help make more complex questions more immediate and approachable for young children.
One of the things that example has raised in my mind is the sort of the difference between philosophy and ethics, because, and I know nothing about either of them, I have to say, but it's made me think that I could probably ask my 14-year-old the question, you know, if someone has a transplant, are they the same person as before the transplant? Like they've had another body part added in belonging to someone else. What makes you you? You know, even knowing nothing about philosophy, that sort of way of thinking, I can understand how you can take that sort of questioning and bring it into other areas that might have sort of ethical dilemmas attached to them.
Yes, indeed. Well, ethics comes from the Greek ethos, which means way of life. And the way we tend to mean, and of course, we use the word ethos in English too, in that way, or very similar. But what it's come to mean, ethics, is how we live, how we should live. So it becomes about what we might consider moral questions. And moral questions and ethical questions fall within the domain of philosophical questions in general. However, there is a difference, and it's important to recognize this. There's a difference between sort of moral precepts or principles and philosophical moral consideration. So, for instance, I might have moral precepts and principles from my own personal principles about how I should live, or from my religious background, I might have those too. But it only becomes philosophical when we start to ask questions like, well, you know, on what basis do we have these? Are these founded? Are these, is it right for me to do X, Y, and Z, or to follow principles, you know, R, S, and T, and etc.? So that's the key thing there to recognize, is that ethics itself is not philosophical necessarily. If I'm just talking about the principles I live by, it becomes philosophical when we start to examine them and think about them. As Socrates said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And that's the kind of thing he's talking about, thinking carefully, deeply about the principles we live by.
Now, returning to children's thinking, you've mentioned some great questions, but you're obviously an expert on the sort of the questions that can open up children's thinking. So what did you mean when you said, you know, river? Oh, that's an interesting idea. Can you explain what you were thinking of when you said that? Can you sort of expand that point of what are the sort of the questions that will help scaffold children's thinking around that dinner table, for example?
Yeah. Well, so here's the basic mechanism that I was going on to explain earlier, and I kind of didn't quite fully say it clearly. So the basic mechanism we go in with is we ask the question, which has to be the right kind of question. So grammatically closed, conceptually open. Next thing I do is I simply ask the children what they think about the question. You know, just say whatever it is you think. And then when they say what they think, such as no or yes or maybe or it depends, I then say, so can you say why you said no or why you said yes or why you said it depends, and so on. So what I'm doing there is I'm asking a question and then I'm what I call opening it up. And because I'm using grammatically closed questions, actually, very often I need to open it up. Because if all you get is a yes or a no or an it depends, you need to then find a way of getting to the open aspect of the question. To do that, you need to open up. So, you know, if they say it depends, the opening up would be, can you say what it depends on? If they say no, I say, can you say why you said no? And so on. Well, there's some really key things here, is that the opening up strategy has to be, the questioning I'm asking has to be content free. So my questioning is purely structural. So in other words, what I'm not doing is saying, so what you mean is, don't paraphrase when I'm questioning. That's really key. Because the moment I start saying back to the child what I think they're saying, what I really do is I hand back to them what I think they're saying, not what they are saying.
That's right, because you have the choice there to open and extend their thinking or sort of almost close down their thinking with your affirmation, you know. So it's fairly really important, isn't it? It's sort of cultivating their thinking in the moment rather than just accepting what they're saying.
That's right. Well, if you were to imagine a closed question represented by a sort of sideways triangle coming to a point, and an open question being a triangle going the other way, coming to an open triangle. The technique I've developed is what I call a question X, where you start by asking a closed question, in other words, a tapering triangle, if you like. Once you've asked the closed question, can you step in the same river twice? Is time real? Or whatever it might be. And then when they say yes, no, it depends or whatever, you open it up, and that's the opening up of the X. So if you imagine a diagram that looks like an X, you've got a closed question, and then you open it up. And that's a really useful strategy to bear in mind. And also, it means that it will avoid you doing the paraphrasing stuff. So you're asking contentless questions, questions which only perform a structural role. So when the child says yes, that's their thought. And when you say to them, can you say why you think yes? Or can you say why you think it depends, et cetera, et cetera? What they then say is what they think, not what you've fed them. So this is really important for dialectic, for that question and answer investigation that the Greeks did so well and that I try to do in classrooms, is I want to give them those basic structural templates to simply get a little bit more from them. And here's a nice little tip for anyone out there on a slightly less technical thing, is that whenever somebody does say something in answer to a question, such as, can you step in the same river twice? If somebody just says yes, you think, great. At that point, you might pass the ball to someone else or go to another speaker. But I'm going to ask you to do the Columbo thing. Columbo used to say, the detective from the TV show, he used to say, just one more thing as he was leaving the room. And he would turn around and just ask one more thing. And of course, very often that one more thing would lead to something really incriminating that would catch the criminal. So what I like to do is to try and think, right, can I just get one more thing from what they've said? Just one more thing. So if one person says no, I might say, well, can you say why you think no? And they might say, well, because the river's always flowing, right? And then I might say, okay, so can I get one more thing from that? So I say, well, can you say what you mean by flowing? Or can you say a little bit more about what you said then when you said the river's always flowing? And it's those kinds of questions which just open up a little bit more, get a little bit more from the child. And then usually from what they say next, you'll often find something else that you can do one more thing with. So that's the key thing here is, can I just get one more thing? And if all you get, so for instance, if you've got a grumpy teenager who you ask a question like that to and they go, oh no, you could say, well, can you say why you don't know? And of course, if they don't want to play, then they'll just wander off. But if they say, I don't know, because it's a bit of a tricky question, you can then say, well, why is it a tricky question? And each step helps you to just get that little bit further. And if you just stick with that principle of just one more thing and use the contentless questioning techniques that I've described today, you'd be surprised how much more you can get from them. Although one last thing I'll say on this is that you've got to ask these questions in the right place and time. So my daughter, if I try and ask her these kinds of questions when I'm reading a story at night, she'll just say, Daddy, stop doing philosophy, just read the story. You have to get the right time and place.
Tell you what, I'd love to be around your Sunday dinner table. I bet you that's fun. I mean, you're making me, you're reminding me of something you said in your, I think it was your TEDx talk, Plato, Not Play-Doh, which, by the way, is the best ever TEDx talk title. And when you said that philosophy is about a kind of conversation, and I think that's really exciting. And you talk about conversation as an art. And what you're really highlighting is the benefit of rich conversation in family life and us thinking what makes a great conversation.
Yes, but if I want to give parents one important hint, around dinner table conversations, kids often get overlooked. They often get talked over. They often get sort of pushed out a little bit, usually because a parent who's, you know, had a glass of wine or two, maybe wanting to make a point or, and this is quite common, quite natural, but I would just say to any parent is the next time you're at a dinner table conversation, just step back. Just let the children speak more. Give them a little bit extra time to speak. Stop thinking about what you're going to say next and just listen to them and see if you can open them up more when they are speaking rather than waiting for them to finish to bring in your points. And I think if you just do those few things around dinner table conversations just a little bit more than you already do, and you might already do it to some extent, then I would suggest that the conversations will include the children better. And we will start to, as we always do when we do this, we start to learn that the children actually have really, really interesting things to say, far more interesting than we might imagine.
And what you're making me think is that we should be paying attention to children's thinking in general a lot more and cultivating their thinking. And we need to be much more patient and listen to what they're interested in talking about. So it might be we initiate a conversation about their favorite computer game or, you know, talk about the current crisis and talk about whether we ever have control over our fears or, you know, is anxiety ever useful? So I think that there's lots of ways in which we can attune to what's going on around them and talk about topics that they already have, you know, had a little bit of thinking about.
Indeed. And I think the key thing is patience. As my wife likes to say, basic hint for parents when working with their children is shut up and listen.
Definitely. You know, that's what I'm sure you and I know, like a great teacher, those are the ones who just give a child time. That's and right. I think in general, we parents can be terribly impatient.
Absolutely. And listening is an art in itself. So for instance, listening is not hearing. Hearing is very different. I can hear a train chanting by right now, but until I brought my attention to it just then, I was not listening to it. You know, so there's a big difference between hearing and listening. And we often hear our children, but we're not listening properly. And one good reason for this is that listening is polyphonic. By polyphonic, I mean, it has different voices, which is a musical expression. And, you know, when I'm listening to you or you're listening to me, you're also listening to yourself respond to me. or I'm listening to myself respond to you. And I sometimes get caught up so much in my thoughts about what you're saying, about the thoughts that I, about what I'm going to say next, that I stop listening to what you're saying. It's very easy to do. And to be able to hang on and be, remain conscious and present in what someone else is saying takes a great deal of effort and will. And for some, it takes more effort than others. And I have to confess, I'm a terrible listener. You know, naturally speaking, I'm very much a speaker. I like the sound of my own voice and I like to say things. So I'm very often not listening to the person that's talking and thinking about what I'm going to say. So I've had to learn to professionalize listening in order to become a good listener. And although I can do that in the classroom very well, I sometimes have to still work very hard around dinner tables to listen like I do in classrooms.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I mean, that is the essence of active listening, isn't it? Listening to the whole body language, to phrases, metaphors that might come up in the conversation. And really, you know, it's such a rich space. You know, one of the things I've been telling parents in the middle of this pandemic is to really offer each other active listening sessions. So you schedule in time just to really, really actively listen to your partner. And those sorts of 20-minute blocks of time are invaluable. I think that they're very rich with connection. And I think people feel very highly valued when they're heard in that way as well.
That's right. Yeah, that's, I mean, I'm a musician, so I am used to listening to things properly and sitting down and listening to music, not just putting it on in the background. And that's a good reminder for me of the way I should listen to people as well. The way I listen to music, I should listen to people. But listening is interesting because it's not just about literally engaging my ears. As you rightly point out, I'm doing all sorts of things in a classroom to listen. I'm listening to what people are saying. I'm looking out for when children want to speak. And sometimes when children want to speak, it's a tiny little lift of the hand, or it's a turn of the head, or even a glint in the eye. And there's a sense in which I have to be receptive to all of those little signs and cues in order to be able to bring those quieter or more reticent children forward. So I would still describe that as a form of listening, all of that.
I want to talk about the benefits of what we've described, you know, the critical thinking skills, children's oracy, obviously empathy, perspective, understanding of different perspectives. Tell us about the benefits of philosophical inquiry for children and all the gorgeous things that you've just mentioned.
Okay, so there's research out there to show that philosophy has some material benefits, such as some improvements in reading and writing, and, you know, and even reduces psychotic tendencies and increases confidence. But one has to be very careful with all these kinds of reports. Much of that's self-reporting, you know. So when children say it increases their confidence, they've just been asked the question, do you think this increases your confidence? And very often children will answer that in the affirmative and not really know what the why or how or what they're saying. So we have to be very, very careful about a lot of those bits of research. But at least they do suggest some improvements and things that we get from it materially. However, the way I'd put it is that when I'm in classrooms and teachers are in classrooms with me, what they see and what they value is the opportunity for the children to have a space to think, a space to reflect on stuff, to be able to get to know their peers better, to get to know their own selves better through philosophical dialogue, through contemplation, through reflection. I mean, how often do they get the chance to do that sort of thing? And I don't need any research to tell me that, you know, how the children are learning about each other. I mean, just a small thing. One little girl called Zoe last week in an online session I was running, she said, right, I've got some things I want to say. And she said, right, I disagree with him. I agree with her. I disagree with him. I sort of agree with her. And she listed about six people that she either agreed with, disagreed with, or sort of disagreed with in all these varieties of qualifications. And I said, oh my gosh, I said, you are listening like a chess player. You know, you're thinking about all the moves that have been made and you're contextualizing what you want to say in the context of what other people have already said. Now, that was a wonderful moment to see a child getting to know their other children and thinking in the context of other children's thinking. So we saw what's known as a community of inquiry really happening there. And the lovely thing was that she said to me, oh, I love chess. But I really like that phrase, the idea of listening like a chess player. But it's also answering your question about the way in which the children become a community, the way in which they think and learn together and understand each other. And by doing so, they get to learn themselves and understand themselves better. So that would say they're the main reasons why we do this. I mean, look, if Socrates had anything to go on, the unexamined life is not worth living. So if we get the children to spend some time examining their lives and thinking and reflecting about them, then that's got to be a good thing, right? If it's not worth living if we don't do that.
Absolutely. Now, I want to talk a little bit about your books, because you just mentioned Socrates. And I think your new book, we're going to backtrack to the older ones in a minute, but I think it's called Corrupting Youth. And we're reminded in the press release, which I've read, that Socrates was sentenced to death for corrupting the youth of Athens. I did not know that, embarrassingly. But tell us a little bit about why, you know, the ancient Greek thinkers matter to us today, you know, in the classroom and at home around that dinner table.
Well, we've talked about this as a conversation, and my understanding of philosophy is very much as philosophy as a conversation, as you've said already. And that, of course, is what the Greeks developed. The idea of doing philosophy through conversation, which, by the way, you don't see if you look up philosophy in the dictionary, it doesn't say it's a conversation. It says nothing about that. It says that it's this discipline of reality and ethics and stuff, and it says thinking about these things, but it doesn't mention anything about the conversational aspect. And of course, you can go to university and do a philosophy degree and not really have many conversations at all. You can hear lots of lectures and read lots of books, and you may have some good conversations. Most of the best philosophy that way is done in the pub with your peers after the lectures, right? So now that's very informal. And what the Greeks did was they had an amazing way of building a system of dialectical philosophy, which is, in other words, conversational philosophy. And the word they would use for philosophy and dialectic was also the word for conversation. So I think that's the thing which we get most of all from them. And not only that, going back to, in the book, I cover it from Heraclitus to Socrates, through Parmenides to Plato and Aristotle. And what they were each doing was that they were each thinking about how to do philosophy. They were thinking about that deeply. Whereas, you know, these days we tend to think about that a lot less. We go to university and we just do it. But they not only asked all the big philosophical questions, but they also asked the question of what is philosophy and how do we do it? And they came up with this fabulous dialectical method of doing philosophy, which is transferable, it turns out, into the classroom with six-year-olds as well as A-level students.
I mean, it's such a meaningful and important book for anyone who's certainly teaching, you know, because it's about philosophical inquiry and you provide that kind of reflection on, you know, the history and the principles of it.
Well, that's right. What I wanted to do with Corrupting Youth was I wanted to basically outline the method and lay it all out as thoroughly as I could. Because all the books I've written before, The If Machine, The 40 Lessons, they're designed to be pick-upable by anybody and be able to use them. But I always felt that there's something slightly missing with that approach. Because if somebody's got a book which is full of lesson plans and they've been given a very preliminary and rudimentary sort of method to use with it, actually what happens is that people don't really do the lesson plans as well as they could. And I think it's about time that I sort of laid out exactly in all its detail the method as clearly as I can. Now, I know I appreciate that that is not necessarily going to be what a busy teacher is looking for. But I think that as with many, many initiatives in classrooms, too many initiatives in classrooms are made to be quick and easy. Corners are cut and people never actually, or very rarely, do they implement the strategies they should be implementing as well as they should. So I feel very strongly that it's about time that I wrote a book which explains it all in as much detail as possible, as thoroughly as possible, which includes the history, the principles, and all the actual classroom practice in great detail, rather than a sort of 10-step plan and then lots of lesson plans, which, you know, quite frankly, most of the time people will only get 30% of what could be gotten out of that lesson plan, approaching it in the quick and easy way.
So just to highlight, I mean, I have all of your books, even though I'm not a teacher, I find them fascinating. I've got 40 Lessons to Get Children Thinking. I've got If, I've got the questioning book that you wrote, I think, didn't you, for Bloomsbury, which is an amazing little book. But I know that you also have an amazing website that parents need to know about. So tell us a little bit about that and the offering for parents on that.
Yeah, so the Philosophy Foundation website, which is the www.philosophy-foundation.org. If people go to that, they'll be able to find all sorts of things. We have events that people can come to for adults. We have a think and drink once a month, which is now online and in fully international. So every once a month we get together and have drinks together and just talk about philosophical conversations together as adults in a very social and informal environment. We have events for children regularly going up online, some are school sessions, but we also have lots of sessions available for children that could just drop in and join with other children. So that's something that parents might be interested in, as well as lots of other events and festivals that we sometimes do and are doing a lot more online these days. So it's become a lot more accessible for a lot more people. So go onto the website. There's also a whole bunch of free resources. You can become a member for free and download loads of free resources that aren't in the books. So yeah, loads to get from the website and a regular newsletter that we send out, letting people know of our latest events and developments. So yeah, I would encourage parents to take a look and get their kids along to some of our events, because more and more we're getting feedback at the moment from schools that the philosophy sessions online are among the best thing of the week for the children. The children love them. We very rarely have kids drop out or not want to come. And contrary to many of what the teachers thought, they've turned out to be really popular and very, very important in this time where the children don't get to see each other very often, don't get to converse with each other properly. They're usually just learning stuff from the teacher. So that's something else that can be encouraged. And of course, if parents want to get their schools involved so that we can actually go into their schools and work with their classrooms, then that's something else parents can do. Power of parents is quite powerful.
I think if anyone is in any doubt as to how brilliant children can be when they're philosophizing, they have to watch your TEDx video that shows that segment when that young child is, I can't remember their name now, I think it was a little boy. He was so articulate and so ingenious in the way in which he went about a particular argument. And it was inspiring. And it made me think, oh my goodness, you know, we really need to find these spaces to have the time to try and allow our children. They're so sophisticated, they're so intellectual, and we don't provide the template for that or the time or the space.
Well, we've got some lovely videos, TEDx talks and other talks that I've done where we've included film footage of children. And what I always like to do as often as possible is include good film footage of children doing philosophy. And there's one story that I've got about when I went up to Edinburgh, invited to give a talk on intellectual virtues, and Alan Hazlitt invited me up, and I gave my talk and I showed my films, and he was supposed to follow with a skeptical view about children being able to do philosophy. And he said, I'm supposed to speak about why I think they can't do philosophy. He says, but after I've just watched those children in action, I cannot deny that they can do philosophy. That was brilliant, you know. And he was watching the same clips that you've just talked about. The lovely thing, Kathy, is that some of those children that you see in those films are now working for us.
Wow, that is amazing.
I've been working, doing this now for nearly 20 years, and we've recently had a few people who you see on those films that we have come back to us and say, I really want to work for you. And they've trained with us, and we now have a few of them actually working with primary school students, just like I worked with them when they were at primary school.
Well, one of the things that struck me listening to some of those children in your video clips, it is so self-esteem boosting to be heard and to have your thinking heard in that way and validated. And it's so exciting for them to have their thinking sort of opened in that way that it's addictive, isn't it? It's exciting.
It is. But what you also see in those clips, particularly the one between Alice and Noah in the Plato Not Plato clip, is you see them critiquing each other. And if you like, taking each other's arguments down. And you know what? That is also empowering and confidence building. So we often talk about confidence building as a thing of, you know, of giving them a voice and giving them an opportunity. But what we often overlook is the importance of allowing them to critique each other, to bring each other's arguments down, to show what's wrong with what they've said. But that's incredibly empowering, especially if they're the ones doing the critiquing with each other. So you'll see Noah being extremely empowered with his ideas and about what he's saying. And he sounds like a little Aristotle. But if you stick around and listen to what Alice says, who's 3 years younger than him at that time, and she literally sees all the problems with what he said and critiques his theory in such a way that he'll either have to reject or revise his theory. And I just think that's just as empowering. And we mustn't forget that kids can be wrong. And kids are also good at seeing how each other are wrong. And we shouldn't overlook the power in philosophy of being able to show and say how somebody or something is wrong.
I mean, it's just making me think it's such a great basis for politics, or, you know, you can just imagine some of those brilliant children that could end up in a career, you know, as a diplomat or a politician. It's just the perfect grounding for it, isn't it?
I suppose what I was getting at was it's often said that what's great about philosophy is that there's no right and wrong answers. And I'm sort of steering people away from that. Because I think one of the best things about philosophy is when the children do see what's wrong with what each other are saying and are able to show why through argument and reasoning and evidence.
How do you feel about this relatively new emphasis on the importance of children deciphering between what is fake news or false information and what is real? I think that sort of dichotomy between false and real is quite hard for children to digest. And I just wondered what your thoughts were on that.
Well, not just children. This question is such a big issue in philosophy. I mean, philosophy is usually broken up into three main topics: metaphysics, ethics, and epistemology. If you do it at university, they're the sort of main topics that you'll cover. And epistemology comes from the ancient Greek word episteme for knowledge. So it's the study of knowledge and how we know things. And that's what you're doing when you do epistemology. So the question of what is truth and how do we know truth and how can we know what is the case, etc., is such a big philosophical topic in its own right that there's an awful lot you could say. And one needs to be very careful with this stuff because yes, it's easy to say philosophy is the antidote to things like fake news and post-truth problems and worries. But we've got to remember that Plato himself was responding to the same worries and concerns. He was responding to the sophists, who were basically saying that everything was relative and there's no absolute truths. Plato was very worried by this concern. So it's exactly the same worry we have now with post-truth stuff. And when somebody talks about alternative facts, it's very easy to say, well, that's just nonsense. There's no such thing as alternative facts. But you only have to look through all the different theories of epistemology and philosophy, and you'll find that there's all sorts of philosophers that actually thought that there are only alternative facts. There's different perspectives and different points of view. There are other philosophers who think that there's only a single truth and we have to discover it. There's other philosophers that think that there's no truth at all and that truth is socially constructed, etc., etc., etc. The question of knowledge is such a problematic one. We cannot take a simplistic view that there is truth and there is fake news. That's far too simplistic. So philosophy is in the business of nuance. And this is so important today. Not just with regard to questions about knowledge and truth, but also with regard to questions to do with things like, you know, gender and race issues that are being talked about a huge amount at the moment. And what's often happening in these debates is that nuance is being pushed out. The finer points are being overlooked for political reasons. So what we need is we need something like philosophy which continues to pursue the nuance and wants to say, look, okay, there are these political reasons why we might feel as though we have to say this or that, but there is still the question of the finer points. What are the further and finer and more nuanced distinctions that we need to bear in mind? And I think there's never been a better time for something like philosophy to come and continue to preserve nuance in a time where nuance is politically not expedient.
And not as attractive. People like black and white sort of answers, don't they?
Exactly right.
Peter, on a final note, we've spoken to you for quite a long time now, but we'd love to know if you could just let, for example, schools know how they can contact you if they're interested in, you know, having you in, as I know you do so much work in classrooms. How would they get in touch?
Well, they can get in touch via our website, or they can get in touch directly with us by contacting emma@philosophy-foundation.org. That's emma@philosophy-foundation.org. That's the best email to get hold of to contact us in order to be able to get the ball rolling very quickly, because Emma is very efficient. But yeah, that's the best thing. Website, go to the website. There's lots of places you can click on there. There's, you know, and get information and emails and stuff. So that's the best way to be able to get in touch with us, I'd say.
Brilliant. Well, I'm sure lots of people will be getting in touch with you. I absolutely love your website. The Philosophy Foundation website is one of my favourites. And I really love, under the resources for children bit, the lovely little videos that you've made, because I think they provide a sort of a starting point for parents who want to start their philosophical inquiry with their children, but maybe just need something to sort of get them going. And I think that's a great asset on your website. Thanks so much for joining me today, and all the very best.
Well, thank you, Kathy, for having me. It's really nice to be invited, and it's been lovely chatting to you. So thank you.
Bye-bye.
This Get a Grip podcast is brought to you by Tooled Up Education, the home of evidence-based tips on parenting, family life, and education. www.tooledupeducation.com. Parents and teachers in Tooled Up schools can also access notes accompanying each podcast, available to read and download from the Tooled Up site.